hemophilia.
The catastrophe of hemophilia.
2 weeks ago, I called them emotional hemophilia.
Mine in particular is a hemophiliac, or a vampire.
Living with hemophilia.
Complication of hemophilia.
Living with hemophilia. Living with hemophilia.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Blood Problems, Reflections on Living with Hemophilia, hosted by me, Michael Bishop. I'm a severe hemophilia B patient with an inhibitor and anaphylactic allergy to factor IX products, and this is my podcast. This is not a podcast about hemophilia necessarily. It's about the life of this particular hemophiliac. And you are listening to episode 4, Self-Care in a World Falling Apart. I hope if you've been listening for a while that you appreciate that shorter introduction. I've been doing my best to make that something a little more concise so I don't punish the people who have listened to all the episodes by regurgitating the same 5-minute spiel every time about hemophilia and about my diagnosis. I hope that that was enough information for new listeners and concise enough that it didn't make the recurring listeners sick of hearing about the specifics regarding my diagnosis. And if you already understand hemophilia, I don't want to re-explain it to you every time you turn on this podcast, because that's not fun. But if you are interested in the specificity, the first 2 episodes I did had a very long introduction that explains what hemophilia is and what my diagnosis is and means. Feel free to go check that out if you are interested in that stuff. But if not, there you go. There was a little short thing. I think that's going to be my introduction moving forward, because it's short. I like it. I am kind of negating the time-saving aspects of it by ranting about it right now, but this will be the only time I rant about how short my introduction is. Anyway, unfortunately, this episode needs to, much like episode 3, needs to start with an apology for me. Again, for my inconsistency in recording and posting these episodes. People have always been super supportive of this project, and I really appreciate it. It's just been difficult to get and keep this ball rolling. Aside from being busy at work, I've also had an incredibly difficult time this year with my physical health. 2020 started out as one of the worst years for me, particularly with bleeds that I've had in the last decade or so. I hadn't been to the hospital since I was in high school, and this year I had been 3 times by April. And I tell you that both as an explanation for once again going on a little hiatus, but also because it's relevant to today's episode. My mental health is always affected by my physical health. And given that this year has been a huge struggle for me physically, it's also been a huge struggle for me mentally and emotionally. I have never been fantastic at strategizing effective approaches to improving my mental health. Throughout my life, I've essentially gone from one poor coping mechanism to another. But I wanted to talk about that struggle a little bit, as I've been forced to address it more than ever this year. And as I said in the last episode, I think observing and analyzing the process is as valuable, if not more valuable, than the presentation of the result, especially when it comes to mental health. Additionally, I think with the state of the world right now, it's important to remember the value of self-care. It's natural to use the world around you to contextualize your individual mental health struggles. In fact, I think you should, especially if your entire country is hurting and there's a particular group of people who need listened to and cared for and protected. I'm not going to provide a list of hot tips for caring for yourself mentally during periods of tempestuous navigations through fighting racial prejudice and global pandemics, but I will be talking about my struggles with it. And as always, I hope that that's valuable in some way. Taking care of yourself is more difficult when there's a specific group of people that needs taken care of right now. And honestly, it feels selfish to discuss anything that isn't directly in service of the greater good or the movements and protests that are going on. Please remember, though, you are only a valuable ally if you're healthy enough to assist your cause. Showing up to build someone's shelter is only effective if you have supplies or experience or at the very least, the will to build. And the ailing of others does not take away your ailments. As selfish as that feels to say, it's important to stay healthy so you have the strength to put deserving people on your shoulders. But before we get into the specifics of my mental health struggles and my thoughts on that generally, I do want to take a second to discuss the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests and demonstrations that are happening across the country. I would be completely tone deaf to not mention Black Lives Matter in any piece of content I'm creating right now. In fact, I didn't even know if I should make an episode for a while. I didn't know if I should be speaking out, or if I should be staying silent and listening, or if I could or should be doing both of those things concurrently. And I don't quite know where to start with this conversation. I've been trying to write scripts for the episodes of this podcast to keep my thoughts clear and concise, or at least have some bullet points to refer to when I lose the plot a little bit or begin to speak tangentially, but it's been incredibly difficult to write this part of the script. I have no idea how to articulate my thoughts on this topic, and I think it's probable that my thoughts are inherently flawed on this subject generally. But like I said, this episode is about taking care of your individual mental health in a world that's in turmoil. This year has been incredibly difficult for me physically and mentally. And when the COVID-19 pandemic started, and when the murder of George Floyd occurred and the subsequent protests began, I was in the middle of dealing with the fact that I was falling back into old, dangerous coping mechanisms. And my attention was taken away from that. And for a second, I wasn't really thinking about it, which was dangerous for me. And I realized that if I didn't refocus on myself at least a little bit, I wasn't going to be useful to anyone, socially or politically. So I hope that makes sense. I want to be as sensitive as I can, especially during a time like this. And I didn't want it to feel like I was trying to create something apart from the Black Lives Matter movement or something selfish in light of it. I am not trying to do that at all. And before I really get into anything, like I said, I just want to take some time to talk exclusively about Black Lives Matter. And honestly, I'm really fucking sad. And I'm really fucking mad, and I don't know in what order. And I wholeheartedly support these protests. Honestly, peaceful or not, I support these protests. And to that point, I've been trying to think about it abstractly and contextualize the radicalness of quote-unquote violent demonstrations. And I've been thinking about them as being comparable to chemotherapy for cancer patients. And I'm cringing already saying that because I know that's such a tired and cliched analogy, but it's the one that I've been using in my head. We have a cancer in this country of systemic racism and police brutality grossly disproportionately affecting people of color. Chemotherapy is a poison that is put into bodies to rid them of a greater, more destructive and dangerous evil. And just as I'm not a doctor who would know when the predation of chemotherapy is not only justified, but a necessary last-ditch effort, I'm not black. And I cannot determine whether or not the cancer of this country has gotten so out of control that it's time to abandon all other, less destructive treatments. I think as a white person right now, my duty is to follow the lead of black voices whose orations are aching to be heard, and to follow the black bodies who are marching for the ones whose soul was stripped from theirs. And I will follow. Through streets or courtrooms or flames, or into a consistent and sustained revelatory introspection, because I know the work that needs done is on my end. And I'd also like to speak to those who are trying to make this movement a politically divisive one. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir in that regard while addressing the audience of this podcast, but because I've spent my entire life living in a state that is more red than not, I've seen so many people trying to cherry pick or manipulate some statistics in an attempt to lessen the impact of this movement or render it unjustified. And in the off chance that someone who thinks they have a damning statistic is listening, please hear me when I say you fucking don't. Even if you think you do, I implore you to reevaluate your allegiance to numbers and graphs and refocus that allegiance towards people. I get it. I'm a nerd too. who liked to have objective, concrete evidence and numbers be the only support of my arguments and opinions. But as I've gotten older, my politics and social ideologies have shifted away from a devotion to a crunching of the numbers or waiting for the study. I try to leave only 40% of my decision-making to those things. So the remaining 60%, the majority, of my reality and my political consciousness has to be informed by other people's truths. If an entire group of people is telling me they feel a certain way, or something is happening to them, I believe them. I will always trust them over whatever number is presented to me, because if I'm ever going to be manipulated, I want it to be because I was trying to be understanding and empathetic and not because I was shown some fucking study by some fucker on Reddit. But even with that being said, this isn't one of those cases where I have to have faith in those speaking. This is objective. This is real. This needs our attention, and we need to be radically changed. And it's difficult. I was also thinking about this. It's difficult to dissect the meaning and deconstruct the intentions of senseless actions. But that is a necessary step towards progress, and it needs to be done. And I think that's where I'm going to leave things in that regard. But thank you for indulging me in that. It's hard to come down from that energy. It's hard to like switch focus. But again, the Black Lives Matter movement is not necessarily the subject of this episode, but I could not talk about anything else, particularly myself or my own mental health, without talking about that first. So thank you for listening to me get my thoughts out. I guess that's what you do anyway when you listen to this podcast, but about that particularly, because it's really important right now. Like I said, my introduction this year has been a gnarly one for me, and it began with three different hospital stays. One for a bad internal bleed in my knee, one for an internal bleed in my iliopsoas muscle, which is a muscle that kind of connects your lower spine to your femur and goes across your hip. It is a bad muscle to internally bleed into. If I was giving recommendations, that would not be one I would recommend. And then there was another hospital stay for a bad bleed in my kidney, an internal bleed into my kidney. I had not been to the hospital since I had my last surgery in high school. I can set up my own IVs, treat my hemophilia at home, by myself, and I can usually control the pain without too much trouble. But for some reason, these bleeds were totally different. And I guess at the risk of going off on a tangent, another one, I would appreciate you indulging me in a discussion about the paradigm of pain management, and I guess the general topic of pain. Physical pain has been a constant in my life. I have no problem saying that I've experienced more physical pain than most people will in their lifetime. I quite honestly don't think that's an unreasonable or exaggerated statement. Some of my first vivid memories as a human being are ones of being in pain, which is fucked. I never really thought about that until I was older, but that's true. Some of my first memories after coming into consciousness as a little human were bleed pains. And I spoke about this a lot in episode 2 of this podcast, but I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights throughout my life. I still experience them pretty regularly. I wrote parts of this script while not being able to sleep because of a bleed in my right ankle after all of these hospital stays just a couple weeks ago. But pain is, of course, relative. And I think because it was a common occurrence in my life, I was able to cope with it pretty well when I was younger. Other than being sad that I had to miss school and I couldn't go skateboard with my friends, I had no real emotional turmoil over spending 36 hours in constant pain, screaming into a pillow and crying until I passed out from exhaustion. That just did not faze me when I was a young man. But pain is just different now that I'm older, man. It really is, I can't articulate why, necessarily. I tap out so much quicker than I did when I was young. When I was in middle school, I tried my best to be the paradigmatic tough guy and grit my teeth and push through the pain, suffer as silently as possible until the bleed went away and the pain subsided. But I'm so much quicker to break now. I feel like I cry much easier at a bad bleed at 27 than I did at 13. And I can't really explain that. It could be that it literally does hurt worse because of the degradation of my joints and the fact that they're displaced easier by blood now. But it could also just be that after almost 3 decades of emotional exhaustion, I'm quicker to hit bottom. The button controlling distress in my brain is just so worn out that it malfunctions and activates immediately. Having terrible bleed pain is also an isolating experience for me. I tend to push people away when I'm hurting because I don't like talking, and I feel bad for anyone around me who cares about me, since they just have to sit there and watch me scream and punch shit and know that there's nothing they can do to make it better. It's really heartbreaking to have my mom or girls that I've dated or roommates around when I'm going through a gnarly bleed. And honestly, it makes it worse because I want to comfort them and let them know that I'm going to be okay, especially if it's a girlfriend or a roommate or friend who hasn't been around me for very long and hasn't seen a bad bleed before. But all my energy is going into just getting through it, so I can't comfort them. So I end up feeling really alone. It's a very singular experience. And all this led to me needing to go to the hospital for pain control. At one point during my kidney bleed, I passed out because of the pain, which is not something that I had ever experienced before. I didn't know that that was really something that happened. I had felt like I was going to pass out plenty of times from pain, but I had never actually passed out. However, I did this time. And I think it's mostly because your breathing is fucked up. I did no research on this, and I should have, because that would have been a nice thing to present to you. But I think it's just because that you're breathing very erratically when you're in pain. And we tend to hold our breath when we're hurting really bad, or at least I do. I tend to, like, I don't even know why. I guess it just helps you focus on the pain, but you tend to hold your breath for as long as possible and then let it out. And I think after doing that so many times this time around, I just passed out. It was not for very long, but it was absolutely horrifying. And that's when I knew that I was going to go to the hospital for that one in particular. I also know a bleed pain is pretty serious when I can't joke anymore. If I have someone around, I always try to make jokes about the situation. And your jokes tend to kill if someone who cares about you is just concerned about you in that moment and you're able to get some sort of joke out. It completely breaks the tension. It's the same way jokes always kill during scary movies, because there's already a tension that exists and you're kind of subverting that by telling a joke. So I always try to make jokes to make the person feel better, and because, you know, I imagine professional baseball players like to hit t-balls because it just feels great to knock one out of the park. But I lost my ability to do that when my friend Brandon was driving me to the hospital for my kidney bleed. It was a 20-minute car ride. At the beginning of the car ride, I was trying to joke as much as possible to make him feel better, because I love him to death, but often panics when I'm hurting. And so I try to put him at ease as much as possible. And for that one in particular, I knew that I was going to have to get some kind of examination, since it was a kidney bleed, and I thought maybe the examination was going to include my penis. And so I told Brandon, please tell the doctor and the nurses that my dick is usually much bigger, but it's just because I'm in pain right now. It's not presentable, which is something that happens, by the way. And he loved it. We laughed. It broke the tension. I was going to try to continue doing that for the duration of the car ride, but then I just could not talk anymore. And he told me later that that's how he knew it was serious as well. He was like, I've never seen you get to the point where you weren't making jokes or couldn't talk anymore. And thankfully, thank you, Brandon, for driving very quickly, getting me to the hospital very soon after that. So there wasn't that much silence, but that's how I knew that one was serious. And being in the hospital for pain management comes with its own set of complications and difficulties. The entire paradigm is pretty difficult to to navigate, I guess. And that's for a number of reasons. First of all, these are very specific things, but you know what? Maybe this will come up for you, especially if you're a hemophilia patient or if you're in the hospital for anything else, like a surgery or something. This might come up and be useful knowledge. So first of all, after being admitted into the hospital, when you're having your pain controlled and getting drugs for it, you do need to ask for it every single time that you get it. It's not like any other kind of medication, understandably, where a nurse or a doctor, typically nurse, is just going to come in and give it to you when it's time. Like an intravenous pain medication, for example, lasts around 2 hours, depending on what it is, I guess. And at least that was my experience these last couple times. And if you're in constant pain, like I was, and know you're going to be in pain for days, that is incredibly frustrating because those 2 hours happen. Honestly, it certainly, in my experience, wears off before the 2 hours is up. You can just receive it every 2 hours. And so I wasn't able to get consistent sleep. And because I had to ask for it and it wasn't something the nurse could administer straight away when the 2 hours was up, you would have to hit your call light and wait for them to come in. Tell them that you want it. They would have to then go to where the drugs are kept and come back. And it was a long time. So it would be more like every 2.5 hours at best that you would be getting the drugs. And that leads to very inconsistent sleep, and sleep deprivation makes your pain a lot worse, especially after, you know, days of having a bleed. It can drive you nuts. And so because of those limitations, you don't want to seem like a drug seeker who is there specifically to enjoy those drugs. And so you don't want to hit your call light early. You don't want to, you know, you start to put on a show kind of and try your best to represent how much you're hurting through your face and through your body language. Because I'm someone who has the reflex of trying to minimize my pain. And like I said, being around my mom and girlfriends and roommates and stuff, try to make everything seem better than it is. But that's the opposite of what you need to do in a hospital, or not necessarily the opposite, because you don't want to make it seem worse, but you want to accurately communicate how bad you're hurting. And that leads to another complication, which is the subjectivity of pain. And, you know, whenever you're in the hospital, it's a 1 in 10 pain scale, 10 being the worst pain you've ever felt in your life. Which for me, I know I'm never going to touch that again. You know, I don't think I'm ever going to hurt as bad as I've hurt previously, even in times like this where I'm like passing out and crying and not being able to sleep. Because I've broken every bone in my leg and I've dislocated my kneecap and like done all of these super gnarly things. So I'm never going to hand out a 10. And you know, I had shared rooms at the Columbus Hospital where I was, and I could hear my roommate, and I quickly got the sense that his 9 was my 4. You know, I would never throw out a 9 on the pain scale chart if I was sitting up and eating and like watching TV. That's not a 9 to me. And so you also have this, you know, the complexity of the subjectivity of pain and being able to communicate that as a patient and interpret that as a nurse. And there's a huge burden placed on nurses and doctors who have to judge the pain of a patient. And I sympathize for them greatly because it's, you know, that's a gnarly thing. And of course people can lie and it's difficult, you know. But even with all that, the hospital is a super comfortable place for me. I don't know if I've ever talked about this on this podcast, but I have like a lot of nostalgia while being in a hospital, and it feels comfortable for me to be in there, even if I'm sharing a room with a roommate or whatever, and it's not the hospital I'm used to. It just feels, I don't know, there's a sense of calm that comes over me, I guess, while I'm there. And I've tried to deconstruct that several times throughout my life, And I think it's because being in the hospital is the one time where I'm allowed to focus exclusively on my hemophilia and exclusively on feeling better. Typically, when I have a bleed and I'm at home, the bleed is the second or third thing on my list of priorities because I'm at home. And I feel obligated to continue to juggle the rest of my life with my bleed, and it absolutely and completely exhausts me. As much as I try to be conscious of that and give myself time to recover before I start worrying about other things, I'm not able to truly let go of the rest of my obligations until I'm dealing with something that's bad enough to put me in the hospital. And then it's like, okay, I'm at the hospital. I'm not at home anymore. Clearly things aren't okay. And I could be experiencing an extreme amount of pain at home, but because I'm at home, I don't have the permission to truly let go of everything else, work or social obligations or anything like that. It just feels like it's only when I'm in the hospital that I can say, okay, fuck the rest of everything. I'm just going to focus on myself and my hemophilia and not worry about the work that's piling up at work. When I was a kid, it was at school or any of that stuff. It's like, okay, well, for the time that I'm here, it's just about getting better. And all of that is to say that I don't think it was necessarily, or at least exclusively, being in the hospital that contributed to my mental health decline this year. I think it was a lot of things. Going on my third year of being single and my second year without my dad. Bleeds just represent loneliness more than ever right now, I think. And I found myself falling back into old habits, particularly that of disordered eating, because I was missing any semblance of control in my life. And after 3 consecutive months of not being able to feel like a normal person who could do normal things, that just snuck up on me. And that's all. Disordered eating has always been about control for me. And so it just snuck up again after not being able to feel in control for quite some time. But I knew what to do. You know, I was reaching out to friends. I was venting openly to them. I was addressing it head on. And then boom, COVID-19, the COVID-19 pandemic started. And then as a result of that, I started staying with my mom so we could be there for each other and I could attempt to quietly recover and stay sane while social distancing. And then boom, George Floyd was murdered by some racist fucking cops in the systemically racist country that bred them. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do for that movement. I still really don't. You know, I don't have the money to donate. I still don't. I'm not in the place physically where I can protest. And I'm still not completely healthy mentally. And so my focus was all over the place. My heart was broken for so many reasons, and I felt selfish for talking to friends about anything other than Black Lives Matter because it felt like the important thing. It is the important thing right now. And I felt myself losing control again because I took my eyes off the enemy. And I had to reach back out to people. I had to continue to recover and heal myself so I can be physically and mentally able to contribute to the dialogue and to the social causes about which I feel passionate. So please don't be afraid to keep yourself in mind while you're doing your best to help others. You need to be healthy. You need to be healthy. And you need to be where your feet are if you hope to march with those you support. You know, don't leave your body. Do not lose focus. Be safe and be as mindful of yourself as you are for others. And of course, as mindful for others as you are for yourself. I think that's where I'm going to end things today. I feel like, I abruptly end episodes, but you know, that's all I wanted to say, I guess. And I wanted to thank you so much for listening again. I can't tell you how much I appreciate people's continued support for this little project. It continues to be a cathartic experience for me. And once again, I hope you find some value in it. I love you. I'll see you next time.
Born with hemophilia.
The catastrophe of hemophilia.
weeks ago, I called them emotional hemophiliacs.
Mine in particular is a hemophiliac, or a vampire.
People with hemophilia.
Complication of hemophilia.
Living with hemophilia. Living with hemophilia.